Hi, Patrick.
Hello there.
How's your memory?
It's not the best. It's not the best. I haven't got the best memory, but what I have got is I can sort of remember conversations. I can't remember people's names, and I can't do left and right.
You can't do left and right?
No, I have to do left for left and right with my, like, do a writing signal with my hand. And that's how I get through.
You put your hand in an L shape.
Left for left.
For left.
You go like a little thing. And my body knows what's left and right, but my brain doesn't.
It's not normal, is it?
Yes, it is.
I've never met anyone who does that.
Well, you just met me. You just need to get out more. And just, that would be your
So you're suggesting that I'm abnormal for not knowing anyone
you
who does that weird thing.
And go up to people and say, do you do left for left and right for right? And you know what? They'd say,
you know what? Most of them will run a mile.
The Match, because 90 minutes can last a lifetime. Episode 6, 16th of September 1995, Arsenal against West Ham at Highbury.
I'd better begin at the beginning, which was a simple request from me to Don Hutchison, formerly of Everton, Liverpool and West Ham amongst others, to do this show and to think of a game that had particular resonance. One came to his mind immediately, and what a tale. The day that the late Les Seeley came on to play up front for West Ham, a day that Harry Redknapp had left Don on the bench and used a goalkeeper as a substitute rather than him. After a torrid time at the club, certainly in recent weeks, that was the last straw, the final humiliation, and Don had chased Harry down the tunnel after the game at Highbury and told him that was it and he would never play for him again. Don had even given me a direct quote as he chased Redknapp and tapped him on the shoulder. That's you and me done, yeah? It was gold dust, a tremendous tale of player versus manager, of ego versus ego, and one that I'd never heard. So we set a date to talk, and I researched the game. And then I realised that Don played in it. He'd been substituted, but he played. So therefore, Harry Redknapp hadn't put a goalkeeper on to play up front instead of him, and that kind of ruined the story. He assured me still that he hadn't played, and when were we doing the interview? I told him that I'd check further and ask two Premier League statisticians, Johnny Blaine and David Wallace, to have a look. They confirmed that he had played in the game and they'd found footage of him playing. That familiar loping stride, that endless energy. He watched it and, despite a date stamp on the footage, asked if we were sure it was the same game. He wasn't having it. He rang John Moncur, who had played that day, who was sure as well that Don had been left out and snubbed at the end. And Don was confused. In the end, a West Ham statistician confirmed that Don did indeed play, and I'll be honest, it threw him. I felt like I'd knocked him off balance and messed with his memories, and was pretty sure he was going to say no to the interview. But he found it funny enough and interesting enough to still sit down with me, and we talked about that day. At least, we think it was that day.
In my mind, Dave, I can remember Harry Redknapp saying to me, get warmed up, you're going on. Arsenal away. So West Ham, Arsenal at Highbury. And he'd made a couple of substitutions. So the last one he had to make was me going on. So I remember him saying to me, get warmed up, you're going on. As I've gone through my stretches, he's gone to Les Seeley, you're going on. And he's put Les Seeley on up front against Arsenal away at Highbury. That, in my mind, is exactly what happened until I look at every single stat and statistician out there and all the records. And it actually showed that never actually happened, which is absolutely bonkers because I'm still convinced it happened. And I phoned John Moncur about 2 weeks ago, telling him I was doing this podcast for you. And he said, it definitely happened, Dutch. It definitely 100% happened.
And yet, what's interesting is we've spoken to every stats person that we know. You've spoken to West Ham as well.
Yeah.
And they say that you played in the game.
There's
The clincher is there's footage of you playing in the game.
Yeah, there's footage out there of me playing in the game. The records show that I started the game and got taken off in and around 75 minutes. So subconsciously, unless I'm going mental, I might have got taken off. Then I've saw Les Seeley go on up front. And then I've just gone mad in my own sort of whirlwind mind that I was furious at Harry. And I had to have an argument about something. But how I've come up with this assumption that I never actually played the game, it's bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. And as you said, the clincher is, go on YouTube, there's footage of me actually playing in the game.
And let's make it clear, playing after 12 minutes in the game. And the funny thing about this story is, I told you there was this footage. I'd spoken to Johnny and Dave, our stats friends, and they both confirmed it. They said to me, I bet when you go and tell him, he'll claim the stats are wrong. I went and told you, yeah. And you claim the stats are wrong.
Of course I did, because you know me. I'm not massively mad on stats. I think you can manipulate them any way you want, but it's clear as day when you look at YouTube or you look at me actually playing for West Ham. I think I was number 17. I think I might have been at the time, or 18. And it's clearly me. I can see my sort of gait and I can see my run, and it's 100% me.
I think what was funny about it for me was when you saw the YouTube footage. I don't know if you remember, but the first thing you said was it must be a different game. You still wouldn't accept it.
I still thought, yeah, but it might have been the season before. Well, there's only one game Les Cilley's ever come on up front in, and it was obviously Arsenal versus West Ham. So I need to do more digging.
You still think it might not be right, don't you?
I still do, because I can remember me and Harry had a massive argument, and it was all based on how can you put Les Cilley on, a goalkeeping coach and a reserve goalkeeper, up front in such a massive game when you've told me to go out and warm up. So how on earth I've dreamt this story up, I'll never know, because as the footage shows, I played 75 minutes of the game.
Now, we talked about this a bit, but I know somebody well who is into the mind and that kind of thing, and they think that what happened is you were so angry about other things, about what was happening at the club and the way you were being treated at the time, and you don't have happy memories of that time, that somehow this story has germinated in your head, that your memory of sitting there being angry is correct, but you were sitting there after coming off in the 74th minute of the game, and your anger has shaped the story to fit the way you wanted it to be. Do you think that's possible? But I think it's true, Don.
Do you know what I'd love to do? I'd love to have a conversation with that person, you know, a psychologist, and wonder how I have generated this story over the years. Because I've told it a million and one times. I mean, John Moncur knows it. So now there's two of us that need to be on the couch. So we both know that story in our heads is true, but unless we've manufactured this story and it was something that I was fuming about, John Moncur got taken off. Clearly remember why. He had a contact lens missing and he couldn't see, and Harry wanted him to go back on. Because I remember that argument developing, because I was yards away. And I'd love to know how the psychology of it all works in terms of, I thought that was true. John Moncur thinks that was true. I then based that on having a massive argument with Harry after the game, which I know 100% is true. And then the stories in my mind just developed and snowballed into, well, it's gospel. It's absolutely gospel. And then you look at the statisticians in the YouTube videos, it's not true.
But isn't it true that if you tell a story often enough, and you'll have been out with John Moncur since, at the time, and of course, since, you know, you've both retired as well, and if you tell a story enough, and this is the funny thing, that the reason I know about this, I heard you telling this story, and that's why I spoke to you about this game, that's why we wanted to talk about it, and then it turns out that it's not true. But I think if a story is told often enough, it becomes true in your head.
It must be, which shows you, really, when we all sort of say about the power of the mind and how much psychology means in any sort of sport. It's so true. And it might be 1%, might be 2% in terms of getting results and playing at your maximum and generating momentum and whatever. But it shows you that you can have a thought process in your mind that never actually happened. And we're talking, it was 20-odd years ago. And in my mind, we giggled when we come through the door, because I'm still pretty sure it happened.
This is therapy, if nothing else, I promise you.
I know, but you need to get me and John Moncur on that black settee and that couch and do some work on us. Because I phoned him, I went, I'm doing a podcast in a couple of weeks' time. And he went, Archie, let me tell you now, it definitely happened. And it didn't. Absolutely nuts.
It is extraordinary. I think there's going to be a psychiatrist listening who's going to make a lot of money. Perhaps the whole team. Perhaps everyone thinks that this is true.
That's probably why we struggled. Ask Sir Alex, by the way, on the last day of the season when we saw Man United win the league, he would have thought we were all nuts at the time, because of the level of performances that we put in that day.
Of course, it was that season, the 1-1 draw, wasn't it, at the end of the season? I mean, I am interested why you were so angry at the time, because that's the root of this, isn't it? I remember you told me that I think this is true. You chased Harry Redknapp down the tunnel, and I think you said that's you and me done to him, didn't you? That was the line. But what was going on at the time that made you so angry, do you think?
Well, me and Harry had a relationship where when I was at Liverpool, he was desperate to get me through the door at West Ham. And me and his son Jamie, we lived together in Liverpool and we were super close. I spent lots of time at Harry's house in Bournemouth, and, you know, come and sign for us, such a love it here. Great group of lads, you know, Ian Bishop, John Moncur, Kenny Brown, Keith Rowland, Julian Dix, you know, sociable group. You'd love the lifestyle down here. And I took the chance and I left Liverpool to come and sign for him. And then it's quite apparent when you work with a manager that when you both like each other so much, but you've got so many different opinions on how the game should be played, it's amazing how easy it is to fall out. And if Harry said something was black, I would argue it was white, vice versa. His methods at the time was all about keeping the football. He had people like John Moncur and Ian Bishop, who was superb at that. I was more of a player that I didn't mind giving the ball away. as long as I could try and feed my strikers with a couple of chances, they get goals, we win the game 1-2-0. My stats are not great, so be it. So bothered. That's what I'm saying about stats. My stats might have been possession kept 50%, but you win 2-0 and you get an assist. That's the way I thought about the game at the time, and I'd never go away from that. Where Harry was the complete opposite. He wanted me to keep the ball more, have my stats up higher, keep possession, keep things ticking along. And we just fell out on our ideas and how the game should be played. And that went into games. I remember a game at the Dell, same sort of year. I'd scored a few goals. We were in and around the bottom six. I was getting us out the bottom three. I scored at the Dell, winning 1-0, 5, 10, 15 minutes to go. We get a ball crossed in from the left-hand side. I take a chance out of midfield and I vacate my position trying to get the second goal. Tim Flowers catches it, throws it to Matthew Letizia. He scores 1-1. Me and Harry have a massive row after the game. Chucks a plate of sandwiches over my head. Goes absolutely ballistic, saying I didn't track him back and I was going, I was trying to get the second goal. He's calling me lazy. I'm going, no, I was trying to get the second goal to put it to bed. So whatever we were doing, we were just two characters that just didn't match up. And if he was in here now, we'd have such a laugh. Because I know he's one of these guys, Harry, that he is your best mate because everyone in football loves him. But when you're playing under him, if you're not on the same wavelength, you can quite easily fall out with people.
And when you do fall out with someone that is a friend, it's harder, isn't it?
Of course, especially when in the afternoon I'm phoning Jamie. And I'm going, your dad's this and your dad's that. It's his dad. Of course he's going to lean towards his old man. And obviously his dad's phoning him going, oh, Hutch does this, Hutch does that. He's a nightmare in training. We keep falling out, da, 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 da. So it's just a shame that it never worked out. But it was just two characters that were just yin and yang. And we just didn't click.
Some people would listen and say, shouldn't you just do what the manager says? I mean, you're obviously, you've got opinions and you've become a very good pundit and you're strong-willed and you've got thoughts on the way the game should be played. But at the time, I think people would say, shut up, listen to the manager and do your job.
100% true. And I totally get that. But if you're taking that side out of my game, then I'm not the type of player that will just pass a five-yard ball just to keep my stats up. Whereas I could get the ball out of my feet, look for Tony Cotty or Lee Chapman, whoever's playing up front, play a killer pass. I remember playing at Everton one game, horrendous amount of rain, and Harry, I think I was playing as a 10, and I wandered out of the left wing somewhere, and I made a crunching 50-50 tackle with Everton's fullback, and then I've whipped an unbelievable crossing on my weaker side of my left foot, and Tony Cotty's got the winner, and I didn't play well. But I'm thinking, assist, goal, 3 points, happy days. That was my thought process.
What did you look for in a manager that you wanted to play for? I mean, I would imagine, from things that you've said, and also from your characters, that your time with Graeme Souness worked because you were a similar sort of player to him, perhaps without the left foot,
but and he was better,
similar sort of character as well.
I love Graham. Two things really. I loved the fact that he was brave enough to give youngsters a chance when the guys at Liverpool at the time were all legends, but they were past the sell-by date. No disrespect, but you know, he wanted youngsters in the side. So you had myself, Steve McManaman, Mike Marsh, Robbie Fowler, Jamie Redknapp, Steve Harkness. So there was plenty of us trying to break our way into the first team. And I'll never forget, I remember him putting on a session, Graham, and he always used to join in and he was super competitive. And I was playing against him and a 50-50 happened. And we both sort of had a green light for a 50-50, even though I'm playing, he's a manager. He wanted to do me and I wanted to do him because it never leaves you. And I'd done him in a 50-50, which riled him. And then about 5 minutes later, I've got a ball at my feet and I know he's fuming and I can see him out the corner of my eye coming in. I've then nutmegged him and I've laughed on the way through. And as I've done that, I'm thinking, oh my God, what are you doing? And I can remember literally 1 second later, I've popped it off to Rob Jones and then he's given me a 1-2 back. And Graeme Souness has gone straight through the back of me. Ridiculous tackle if it was two players, but on a manager player, ridiculous, could it have injured me. And he got me by the throat and he pinned me down and I'm wrestling with the manager on the floor and the lads are absolutely loving it. He played me on the Saturday because he knew I had that character about me. He knew I was willing to go toe-to-toe with the manager, so he loved the character that I had, and I loved him for it.
Do you think he did that because he was trying to test you out and see if it was all mouth or if the toughness of the character was there too?
I think a bit of both. Even, I think more so, I probably dented his pride because he was one of the best players in Liverpool's history. And A, winning a 50-50, B, nutmegging him, and then three, rolling around the floor in a sort of wrestling match that never really went too far because he was always going to win. I think he liked that, and the fact that, well, I wasn't just going to lay down. I wasn't just going to go side to side, if you like, talking about the Harry Redknapp thing. And I had a bit about me. And, you know, I played a lot of games under Graham.
Do you think you were a hard character to manage? You're obviously a very committed player, but again, not short of an opinion. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but a strong, strong character to manage, I'd imagine.
I think in my younger days, yes. And I would love to sit down with Harry and say, what was I like from your perspective? Because in my perspective, it was all your fault. And I'm sure you'd say, well, from my perspective, it was all your fault.
Have you never spoken to him about that?
Not really, no. I think too much time's gone. Not too much time's gone in terms of, I'd still bring it up because I love him. I've never really had the opportunity. I think I've worked with him maybe once or twice in about sort of 15 years. And we've not been in this environment where you can have a cup of coffee and sit and chew the fat. But I know for a fact, when I see him, we'll put an arm around each other. I know for a fact because I like him and he likes me. It was just, as I said, it was just two completely contrasting characters. But Graham was a character that is easy to fall in love with because he's, I don't understand sexist, but he's a man's man. You know, he wants to talk about football. He wants to be in an environment that loves to talk about football and have that conversation and is easy to get on with. If any game's gone on in and around the world, you can watch it and you'll have a conversation with him. He's so easy to talk to, but he's passionate and he was a winner. And how can you not respect someone like him? Because he was one of the best.
Is it about clearly defined goals being a good manager, do you think, from your player's perspective? Is it about knowing what you are supposed to do when you go out there? And not just in the 90 minutes, Dom, but yeah, around the club as well?
It's a good question, because when you're young, you don't really think of that. You're very selfish. Footballers are selfish anyway, even when you get older, because you look after yourself. That's the way it has to be. You see the amount of managers that come through doors and players never really change because it's all about yourself. But I don't think when you're young, you set goals. Maybe the modern day player is completely different. In our era, we worked hard and we play hard. And you went from week to week. And it's a shame, really, because I can remember leaving Liverpool. And I can remember someone saying to me, who's the biggest club you've ever played for? And it was, without a question, Liverpool. But it was the norm walking out every other Saturday, out onto Anfield, look at the cop, them singing You'll Never Walk Alone. Sadly, that was the norm. And only when you go away from Liverpool and you retire, you think, wow, man, that was something special. I was very, very lucky.
It's interesting. It's a shame you can't be the older you,
exactly,
in the younger you's,
exactly,
body, isn't it?
Exactly that. It's like you wish you could transport all the experience you've got in your late 20s, early 30s into them young 18-year-olds' legs, because you'd be an unbelievable player. All of us would. Anyone you ever want to mention. You know, people are running around like, you know, 100 miles an hour every single game. I remember Graeme Souness telling me once, and I'll never, ever forget it. And he said to me in a game, after a game, he turned around and he went, you run around too much. And I went, is that not a good thing? And he went, no. He went, what you need to learn is you need to let the game come to you. And he left me with those thoughts. And I walked away and I thought, I've got a clue what he's talking about, right? But I sort of know, he knows best, but I didn't know what he meant. Let the game come to you. What does that mean? Let the game come to you. If I need to close him down, I need to close him down. If I need to be the cross-country runner that I was, because I was playing with Jan Molby and Ronnie Whelan, I'll be their legs. I'll be their box-to-box. And I was an ex-cross-country runner when I was young. That's what I need to do. And I got to 28, 29, and I was at Everton. And I can remember not being fully fit. And I played in a game, and I was probably 80% fit, 90% fit, but I had the commitment to go out there and play. And I remember standing still-ish for 90 minutes. I had one of the best games I've ever had. And it was one of them, light bulb, let the game come to you. And I stood still, and because my positional sense was good, everything seemed to go through me. You know, I was just like a beacon for everything. It was coming off the right-hand side, coming into me. I was going at the left, vice versa. Centre-halves were giving it to me, playing it around. And I was like, man, I'd done too much running when I was young. But you had to at the time, because that was your role.
One of those overused phrases now, isn't it? Football intelligence, game management, that kind of thing. But that's, I suppose the greats have got that when they're 17.
Exactly. You know, if you think of someone that straight away pops into my head, Teddy Sheringham. What a football brain he had. I played with him when he was at West Ham. And he never had any pace whatsoever. So he relied on his football brain. And you get it when you're older. You get into your 30s. I remember lots of times when I was at Coventry and playing for Luton, and I found the game quite easy in terms of getting on the ball and controlling things, not in terms of getting around the pitch, because then all of a sudden your brain's clever but your legs are going, so it's like, what's going on? So that's why people say about someone's peak, you know, you're at your peak because you're physically fit, your legs are great, you can go box to box, you're developing a football brain. That's when you're at your peak. It's a shame that it doesn't last too long.
I just want to take a slight sidetrack here in this story of you and forgetfulness, or is it?
Yeah.
We'll find out one day. And your managers as well. And talk about your first manager, who was an extraordinary character at Hartlepool. You didn't play many games there. I think it was 24 games, but you did play under Cyril Knowles. And it's only because I've heard you say this, but he had an extraordinary way of bigging you up and knocking you down, didn't he after games? All of you, not just you.
Yeah, he loved cars. Honestly, he loved cars. I remember pre-season training. He used to put a certain run on around the docks of Hartlepool, and it was a rascal run. It was like, It was like a 45-minute hour's run, but you had to run past train tracks. And if you timed your run just off it, the train went by, the barriers come down, and you're losing time. So it was one of these runs that you never knew what because we were never savvy enough to work out the train times. You just went, go, and you went. And I remember him saying beforehand, whoever wins this race gets tomorrow off, but you've got to wash my car. Right, and we had this one runner, lad called Stephen Brown, who was unbelievable. He won every single time. But the reward, if you like, or punishment, was washing his car. And he took that into matches. I can remember him coming in after games and he'd go, hey, Rob McKinnon, Rolls Royce. And then he'd go, hey, Don Hutchison, Mini Metro. And you go, no, not a Mini Metro. And he'd go, hey, Joe Allen, Ferrari today, by the way. And you knew on the strength of what cars he mentioned, how well you played. And it was like, it was bonkers, but it was because it 18, 19, he was my first ever proper manager. So you think at the time, you think everyone's doing it. So you're thinking like, it's unbelievable. And then he gives you the Rolls Royce Ferrari one and you're like, buzzing.
So even though it's funny, it still works, Mind works in mysterious ways. Now, you obviously had, your career is quite surprising, isn't it? Because you moved a lot. Yeah. I think your maximum you played at any one club was 70 odd games, crazy. I think. But you had a lot of legendary managers, really, because not just Souness, but Howard Kendall as well, who took you from Sheffield United to Everton. That was after the match we're talking about, after the first West Ham experience. So you hear a lot of stories about Howard Kendall, obviously an absolute genius in the 1980s, an incredible Everton team. What was he like to work with?
He was your father figure. He was the man that I still shed a tear nowadays when I sit back and you're sitting on your own and you've got a little time to think about what you've done and how your life's going and this, that and the other. And he was a massively sad loss for me. I lost my dad when he was quite young. He was a miner that done 35 years down the mines and he had a tough job. And Howard took that mantle on, whether he wanted it or not, he took it on. And when he signed me, you know, we talk about me and Harry didn't, you know, not seeing eye to eye. Me and Howard adored each other. I mean, honestly, like the best bromance you've ever had in your life. And he was just such a joy to play under. Every single training day was fun. I remember me and Gareth Taylor, Welsh International, used to drive in together and we used to laugh on the way to training, knowing something was going to happen and something was going to make a day and make it special and make it funny. And that's what Howard had. He had a terrific sense of humour. Another one that you could sit in front of any football match around the world and talk football. You could sit and have a beer with him or have a meal with him within a matter of seconds. The topics turned back to football. 101 stories, like any Evertonian or guys that have played under him. What a couple that stick in my mind. One was, I can remember pre-season, and he had a ritual, Howard. He was, you know, he's one of these guys that when he'd done something, he wanted to carry it on as much as he could. And I can remember he put a thing called Chinese Tuesdays on. And it was basically, if you have a good result on a Saturday, we'd have a Chinese on a Tuesday. And it was literally eat as much food as you can and drink as much beer as you can with Wednesday off, because that's your reward. You'd have to tell jokes or sing a song, you know, all in good spirits. And we had a start of the season where we were on fire. So we had Saturday games, we had Chinese Tuesdays, Saturday games, Chinese Tuesdays. And we went away from home and we lost a game heavily. And he come in afterwards and he lambasted every single player. The worst I've ever seen Howard. Howard was a guy that he always sort of said, once the game's done, do not bring it in the next day. Don't mope around the place because you can't do anything about it. I want to see smiles on your faces. No one mope. Anyway, he's gone ballistic at every single player. He's gone at the goalkeeper. He's gone at the back four. He's gone to me. He's gone at the midfield, hammered the centre forwards. And then he's gone, right, he went, I'm that disgusted about the performance today. Chinese Tuesdays are finished. Absolutely finished. Well, at that point, the lads are more devastated about Chinese Tuesdays than actually dropping the 3 points. And he recognised that as quick as a flash. And he went, hey, by the way, he went, Chinese Tuesdays are finished, but now they're on a Wednesday. So it was one of them where it was like, genius move. Absolute genius move. The other one was at Wembley in the playoff final against Crystal Palace. I broke my right wrist, dislocated my left shoulder, got stretchered off. I sat on the coach in a couple of slings. I had no arms. The lads start getting on the coach afterwards, start realising that we've lost the game because they're crying. Howard then comes on, he's immaculate in his suit, always was immaculate dresser. And he come to the back of the coach and he give me a bottle of Budweiser and he went, hey, by the way, he went, I absolutely love you. He went, I love you. And I've gone, he's gone to hand me the bottle of Budweiser and I've sort of, you know, gestured down that I've got no arms. And he went, hey, and he's flipped his jacket open and he's got a straw in his jacket and he just takes the straw, pops it in the top of the Budweiser bottle and he went, I love you. And walk back to the front of the coach. And it was like amazing. How can you not love this guy?
No, it's fantastic. Given the some of the context of the rest of your career, it was interesting. It was a bottle of Budweiser, but we're not going to go there. Don't worry about that.
Who are Budweiser?
There you go.
That was a West Ham song.
There you go. I'm amazed you didn't get an ad campaign out of that. Incredible. Yeah. I come from a family of Evertonians, and I remember interviewing Howard Kendall late when he's at Notts County, and it broke my heart, really. And it must have been the same for you. So I think we'll move on from that. It's probably a different interview, I think.
He was the only manager I've ever sort of, when I've left him years later, and I got my big money move from Sunderland to West Ham. And I can remember the very first day, or the day when I signed, the very first day I had a chance, which was a couple of days' time, I made a point into going to central London, and I went into the best cigar shop I could find. And I bought this walnut box and filled it full of the best cigars. I'm not a smoker, so I haven't got a clue what they are. And I spent loads of money on him, and I sent it to Howard, and he phoned me the next day in tears. I can't believe you've done that for me. And that's what ex-players would do for Howard.
Yeah, that says a great deal about him. You also played under Walter Smith and Craig Brown, two very underrated Scottish managers that are highly rated in Scotland. I'm not sure they get the credit they deserve elsewhere. Craig Brown was a manager you loved playing for.
Yeah, Craig was brilliant in terms of very laid back. It was never about him. All about the players. I speak very fondly of him. And I knew a few guys, Derek Ray, commentator, who's in contact with him quite a lot. And when the topic of football comes up and the conversation about Scotland and what he was like and who he liked, he seems to like me, which is really, really nice. Scored big goals for him, scored out in Bremen against Germany, obviously scored against England as well. But he was a guy that was never at the forefront of any headlines, really. It was all about his players. Wasn't interested in looking good or coming up with waffle after games like some managers do. And he told the truth. He was just A1, just straight down the line.
And how important is that straightness with players? Is that almost, as well as knowing your job, in terms of getting a player's relationship, is that almost the most important thing?
I think so. I think I don't mind managers coming out these days and using the psychology card in terms of I'm protecting the dressing room. I don't mind that because I can see it. Some fans can't because it's different when your team's played rubbish and he hasn't come out and a certain manager hasn't nailed a few. I like that. That's why I like Graeme Souness and Peter Reid and that sort of character that would just nail someone for not playing well, but also praise you when they're doing well. So I get when managers are doing that. But Craig would never do that. Craig Brown would never, ever do that. He'd take it on the chin himself. My responsibility, I didn't pick the best side, blah, blah, blah. And that's the way of taking the heat and keeping the group of players together and keeping them confident. And that's one of Craig's strengths.
And Walter Smith always strikes me anyway as a good man, but a tough man. And you must have known what your job was under him.
Definitely. Well, if you got two peas in a pod, it's Graeme Souness, isn't it, and Walter Smith. You know, the time they had at Rangers, they had many years together at Rangers. And I think more or less everything Graham learned was probably under Walter. And he was a tough guy to please, but at the same time, liked to test your character. I remember pre-season training, and he signed Marco Materazzi, he signed John Collins, he signed Kevin Campbell, and he signed a player called Olivier Decor, who was a sensational player. And he pulled me in pre-season, he went, look, he went, you're going to struggle to get in this side. He went, if you want to look for a move, he went, give you my blessing. He went, you can speak to your agent. And I went, why? And he went, well, I've signed John Collins and I've signed Olivier Decor. You're not going to play. And I went, I'm better than him. And he didn't know me really from Adam. He probably did. I'm doing him a disservice really. But he didn't know what my character was like. And he went, what do you mean? I went, well, just because you've brought them through the door. I went, I'm better than him. I'll show it. I'll prove it to you. And then about a week before, managers always do this when they're building up to the first game of the Premier League season. They always put their strongest 11 against the reserve 11. And it was one of the most fiercest games. It's always fierce anyway if it's halfway through a season when the reserves are playing the first team because there's always that niggly, I'm better than them type of thing. But he upset about half a dozen of us, Walter, by more or less saying, you're the reserves. We're practicing against the first team because they've got a really important game next week, opening day of the season. Well, me and Olivier Decor battered each other in this game. And I've topped him in a game. I've then topped John Collins, who cost, you know, fortunes, and so did Ollie. And then the gaffer fell in love with me. And I played under him, and then I was captain a year later. So he again, like the Graham one, he tested your character and see how it would have been quite easy for me to turn around and go, yeah, okay, I'll move because you've got two players that you brought through the door. I was having none of it. I thought, well, just because they're new, you know, doesn't make them any better than me. Just because you bought them for big money doesn't make them any better than me. So that was the character I was, and I think he loved me for it.
In retrospect, looking back, do you think he did that deliberately? Do you think he never was going to move you on, or do you think it was genuine?
No, I think it was genuine. I think it was one of them, when you spend the amount of money that he'd spent on Ollie and John, two phenomenal players, you know, two guys that have got unbelievable CVs. You're never signing them and not playing them. So you had to find a way of playing them two and getting me in the side at the same time. Took him a little bit of time. Took him time to work out that he could play me as a 10. He could play me off either side. I didn't really care. You know, I've played in a number of positions over the years. Never really nailed down one of them. So I think he liked to test me. But I think at that time it was genuine.
Now, given all that you've taken on from these legends of the game, really, these, although one rule, I think you said something that combined them and linked all these managers. One clearly is, if you want to be remembered and rated as a manager, don't sign Don Hutchinson, because all these people are underrated, really, apart from Howard Kendall as coaches. But do you ever fancy it, do you think, with all this stuff you've taken on board? Is it something that ever appeals to you? Because you like the tactical side and you love Italian football, which has all the tactics. You're obviously aware of what good man management is.
Yeah.
But you're shaking your head already.
I am, because what I'd love to do, if I didn't love doing the job I'm doing at the minute, which I completely adore, is I'd love to coach kids. I've done it, listen, nowhere near any sort of level. I've done it from a boy's side when he was 12, 13, 14. And the enjoyment you see when you put on a session and you put it on for a purpose, not just a session, but in terms of, we're doing this because this will help you on a Saturday or Sunday. This will help you. I remember we had a striker, boy called Mo, and he was 14, 15, and he was bigger than me, about 6'2", really gangly, but a real talent, a real player. And I knew the opposition that we were playing at the weekend, and there was a little kid playing at right back who was slightly overweight, shall we say, without being unkind, but loved the game and playing for a reason because he loved sport. And I played Mo on the left wing before the game. He was like really disappointed, and he goes, "Yeah, but I'm a centre forward." I goes, "Mo, I want to play on the left wing today. I want you to score three." I went, "Trust me." And he played on the left wing and he scored three. Absolute world. He's cut inside on his right foot, bent at the top corner. And I got so much satisfaction. And I felt really good about myself, not in terms of ego or anything like that, but I thought, man, that's what coaches do. But more importantly, I love watching kids play sport, whatever it might be, tennis, golf, football, whatever kids do and they're playing sport, I love it. And I love the faces on them. So I was ever going to go into something, that's the route I would do, because I totally get kids playing footy. I love it.
The other thing that's shone through as we finish this is your memories of the managers you loved are all incredible. The stories, the details, everything. I wonder if that's something to do with the memory thing as well, because you weren't enjoying yourself. Perhaps you just don't have good recollections about that time, and that's maybe why you've got that day wrong.
Maybe because... again, I mean, I would genuinely love to sit down with a psychologist and work out why that story's developed and for what particular reason. Maybe it's because the majority of my career was good. Maybe it's because I let a manager down that I wanted to do so well for, because he was my best friend's dad. And maybe I was so annoyed that our relationship never blossomed into loving Harry like I did, Howard Kendall and Peter Reid and Graham Souness. And it's a great shame, and I'd love to sit down and maybe do something with Harry and just sit there and talk and find out. He goes, and he might, yeah, but oh, you're a nightmare to coach. See, in my mind I was a dream, but I know for a fact I wasn't under Harry, because we had so many arguments. And it's just proper fascinating, the psychology of sport.
And just finally, because I think it needs to end where your career began. On a scale from Mini Metro up to Ferrari, let's say, and other cars are available, no disrespect to them. Yeah. What do you think you were at the end of things? How would Cyril Knowles sum up your career at the end of it?
Hey, Don. BMW, Mercedes-Benz. Never a Rolls-Royce, lad. Never get ahead of your time. And you weren't as bad as a Mini Metro.
Next week on The Match, a story of being a young footballer at an old club, of not really knowing what you were doing. A story that's called 28 Minutes with Andy Sinton.
My problem was I didn't really get much coaching. What I needed then was coaching. But as I say, I was in a very senior set of professionals who were very good at coaching, taking me to the pub, and I certainly learned to drink and do the social side of Liverpool. But actually learning to be a right back wasn't quite so easy at the time.
The Match is a Speechless Media production in association with IMG Media, and thanks to all of those involved in it for their support and considerable skill. They are Matt Vines, Steve Tebb and Ollie Neen, and all of the IMG team. And thanks too to Don Hutchison for his time and his patience, and of course, for his memories. You can follow us on Twitter at The Match Podcast, and we'd really appreciate it if you could take the time to rate and review us on iTunes. It makes a big difference to what we can do and where we can go in the future.
To stop and mourn, I dreamed you'd gone. Woke and saw you and cradled your head, thought of a million things and more that I could say to you instead. We passed the time, dear, and I cradled your head. I like to keep things simple, I hate to get too solemn. If I say that people kill for what we got in common, would it be too ungrateful to say it's just not enough for us to remain? I think last night